Hello, everybody. On the line, I heard a few people beep in, and it looks like it's 12:15. This is Betsy Lapoitevin at the Nature Conservancy in Missouri. Just want to thank you all for joining our Scientist Showcase. Just a reminder, if you have any questions during this conference call, you can give us an email at missouri.events@tnc.org, and we'll work to get your questions answered. Also, we are anticipating being able to post this conference call on our website at a later date, and those of you that have sent emails to me, I'll make sure that you know when it's posted. Doug Ladd is the Director of Conservation Science for the Missouri Chapter of the Nature Conservancy. He has been involved with conservation planning, natural area assessment, management, restoration, and research for more than 30 years, with particular emphasis on vegetation and fire ecology. Recent work has concentrated on vegetation and fire ecology, Midwestern prairies and woodlands. Developing assessment and ecological monitoring protocols for terrestrial vegetation and ecoregional conservation planning. He has undergraduate degrees in botany and chemistry and a master's degree in botany from Southern Illinois University, where his thesis research was conducted under Dr. Robert Mollenbrock on the flora and vegetation of north central Vermont. In addition to numerous articles and reports, he is the author of two plant field guides, Northwoods Wildflowers and Tall Grass Prairie Wildflowers, and he's the co-author of Discover Natural Missouri and Distribution of Illinois Vascular Plants. Today, Doug is here to talk about a botany sampling project happening in the Nature Conservancy's Chilton Creek Preserve. Chilton Creek is the largest Nature Conservancy preserve in Missouri, consisting of over 6,000 acres. It's home to over 700 species of flowering plants. Currently, a six-member botany crew is there monitoring 250 vegetation plots to help gather data as part of an ongoing study of the impact of controlled burning on the area. I'm going to stop now and turn this over to Doug, our resident expert on Chilton Creek, so he can tell us about what's going on down in the Ozarks.
Thank you, Betsy. Thank you all for listening in. I understand everyone's line's muted, so no one can heckle me, so I've got the perfect audience here. What I'd like to do today is just briefly talk about Chilton Creek and a little bit of its history, because it, as Betsy said, it's the largest nature conservancy preserve that we have in Missouri. I'd like to talk about its significance and why the conservancy is involved there. Talk a little bit about what we're doing there this summer, and then conclude with talking about what this means, what we're seeing in terms of early results, and how this fits into the bigger picture of conserving and sustaining our conservation resources, both for public benefit and for biodiversity. The Nature Conservancy acquired Chilton Creek Preserve as part of a bigger package of about 83,000 acres we acquired from the Kerr-McGee Corporation when they divested themselves of their timber operations in Missouri. These lands were all concentrated in the Missouri Ozarks, which is a priority for biodiversity conservation in North America, and we felt that it was important that they be sustained in conservation management. So the Nature Conservancy, in cooperation with the Missouri Department of Conservation, structured a deal to buy 83,000 acres of timberlands from the Kerr-McGee Corporation. We then did a rapid ecological assessment, and it became very clear that the 5,600 acres or so that encompassed Chilton Creek were notably higher quality in terms of conservation resources and biodiversity than the lands at large. And this is probably because they were more isolated and more difficult to get to. So we ended up transferring most of the other land to other conservation entities, mostly to the Department of Conservation, but we felt it was important enough and offered enough opportunities for demonstration and woodland rehabilitation to keep Chilton Creek as a Nature Conservancy Preserve. So it has been managed by the Nature Conservancy since the 1990s. Historically, we know that that part of the Ozarks along the current river there, and for a geographic location, if you're familiar with the town of Van Buren along the current river, Chilton Creek is about 7 miles as the crow flies, about 20 miles as the car drives, northwest of Van Buren along the west banks of the current river. This is very rugged, highly dissected, hilly terrain. Historically, it was a very open woodland of shortleaf pine and oak pine mixtures. And we know historically that much of the Ozarks was like that and very open. We have strong evidence that much of the reason that the Ozark woodlands were originally very open in character was because of regular fires that had been set by the Native Americans who had lived there for 10,000 years or more prior to European settlement of the area. By the time the Nature Conservancy acquired Chilton Creek, it was like most of the other woodlands in that part of the Ozarks. It had been used for various forms of timber management for multiple generations. Originally, it had been used industrially. Its first industrial use was by a corporation called the Moss Tie Corporation, which had strong ties to St. Louis, and they used it for railroad tie production. Kerr McGee acquired it in 1963 and continued industrial forestry at a relatively low level on the tract. But prior to that, as I said, we know that it had been used by Native Americans for thousands and thousands of years, and that fire was a part of that landscape. As one example of what the Ozarks looked like, I'd like to just share with you a quote from an early traveler into that part of the Ozarks. And he says, I quote, this is a someone, George Featherstone, traveled through that part of the area in 1844, and this isn't directly to Chilton Creek, it's an area to west of it, but I think it characterizes what the Ozarks looked like. He says, when the country was first settled, the timber was not so dense as it now is, now being 1869 compared with his 1844 trip and his accounts with the early travelers. It had been the custom of the Indians annually to burn the forests over after the grasses had become dead and dry and the leaves were arid. They did this to facilitate their opportunities for hunting. This annual burning killed the germs or young sprouts of timber and thus prevented a dense growth of underbrush and young saplings, such as now appear in the country. As soon as the country was settled and these annual burnings ceased, the young timber began to grow, and almost everywhere in the forest where timber once was sparse, it has become dense. And that and many similar accounts like that have led the Nature Conservancy and other scientists to start looking at the role of fire in shaping and maintaining the original woodlands of the Ozarks. And it's not our desire to try to bring the Ozarks back to some utopian pre-settlement state. We couldn't do that if we wanted to do it. But we want to keep all the plants and animals that are originally a part of our Ozark systems as functional components of intact, sustainable Ozark habitats and natural communities. So we're using Chilton Creek as a place to test the role of large-scale woodland fire in rehabilitating and maintaining diverse woodland systems in the Ozarks. So we've taken the 5,600-acre Chilton Creek Preserve, we've basically carved the whole central part of it, the watershed of Chilton Creek, into a series of five fire management units. We then annually we apply fire somewhere in that landscape to one of those five units at a randomized 1 to 4 year return interval. So the average return interval for the fire is every 4 years, but there's a random treatment so that fire may occur 3 years in a row in some units. In addition to that, we have a unit we're burning annually to test the role of annual fire in woodland restoration. We partnered with the Missouri Department of Conservation, who's very interested, obviously, in both the forestry potential and the conservation potential of woodland management in the Ozarks. They have a large-scale project going similar to this called the Missouri Forest Ecosystem Project, called MOFEP, where they're testing the role of various forest harvesting or non-harvesting practices. And we've added the fire management treatment to part of the study. As I said, we do this in collaboration with the Missouri Department of Conservation. So we've set up these large-scale prescribed fire management units. We have a randomized system for burning them that would emulate, we hope, fairly closely the original fire pattern that would have been imposed by the Native Americans and to a lesser extent by lightning fire. And then to get the data we need, we spent a couple of years before we started fire treatments and put in a series of 250 permanent plots through the entire fire landscape there. These plots were stratified so that the number of plots is proportional to the aspect and slope, topography, and vegetation of the areas within the unit, which is a fancy way of saying we've tried to make the number of plots representative of the landscape as a whole. Then before we did the first fire, which occurred in the end of 1998, as I said, we got 2 years of data where we had crews go out, and at each of these 250 permanent plots, they sampled a series of nested plots within each large plot to determine the trees, tree size, tree structure, tree composition, the shrubs, and then the ground vegetation, all the wildflowers and grasses and sedges and herbaceous plants. And we recorded the species and the cover of every one of these. So we have a very explicit snapshot of the vegetation of this type of Ozark woodland prior to any treatment at all. Then we then started applying our fire treatments. We did a little bit of resampling in 2001 just as a gut check to see where we're going. But this year is kind of exciting because in 2009, 9 years after the first fire, or I'm sorry, 11 years after the first fire management there, we've done a detailed resampling of the vegetation there. And to do that, again, we partner with the Department of Conservation. The site's very remote. The Department of Conservation has some housing fairly near the site, so we can get the crew there within a 40-minute drive every morning. So the Department of Conservation provides co-funding for the project with us. They provide housing and vehicles for the crew. We provide co-funding for the project. We provide daily supervision, training, and all the data management analysis. So we hired from around the country six promising either upper-class or graduate students or recent graduates from life sciences and environmental studies. We put them through a crash two-week course in Ozark botany, which was probably more grueling than anything they experienced in graduate school. We tested them every night. The difficulty is we have to, in a very short time, train a series of people to be able to go out to these plots and to be able to identify all the plants that would fall in their sample plots, regardless of whether they're in flower or a brand new sprout or been gnawed on by deer or whatever, because this project is contingent upon accurate identification of all the species of the vegetation, so we can determine the net changes that have happened in the last 11 years. So after this training course, then we've had this crew spending their entire summer getting up pre-dawn every morning, driving out to the site, which is accessible only by a rugged four-wheel drive road, and then hiking to whatever plot they're sampling at that time, sometimes a mile or more of up and down over these steep hills, and then in two-person teams, they go out and they sample the vegetation. They're just completing that process, and I was just telling Betsy, we are always sweating in an average year whether we're going to complete the process, but they completed the process as of noon or one today. They should have done the last plot, so we have completed the 2001 sampling data. We obviously don't have the results. We'll be analyzing that and providing a final report to the Department of Conservation by the end of this year. But we already know, just from working on the site, that there have been profound changes with the advent of fire. Some you might expect, because we've opened up the canopy some. There's been more light reaching the ground level. There's more herbaceous plants, more wildflowers and grasses in the understory. I think the overall impression compared with when we first acquired the property is one of much more lushness. It's greener, there's more stuff on the ground, there's not areas that are bare and full of leaf litter and overshaded like we saw before. Surprisingly though, probably because we all have these images of fire that come to us from the media and these catastrophic wildfires that make it to the national news at night, but surprisingly, despite the long history of a decade of fairly frequent fires at the site, it's amazing in many cases how little the canopy trees have been affected. So you're creating this atmosphere there, this structure where there's a fairly dense canopy of trees as there were before. There are not near as many shrubs as there were, but it's still a fairly shaded environment. And so we're still exploring what the ultimate resolution of this will be. It may be, in order to reach the structure that we know was there in pre-settlement times, we have to go in and do some silvicultural treatments and some thinning as well as fire. But we do know fire has played a major role in bringing the ground cover vegetation back in terms of both diversity, number of different species that is, and cover at the site. There's been a few interesting sidebars that have occurred as well. There's a plant in Missouri, a little creeping plant that's in the bean family called a type of tick trefoil or a sticktite. And it had not been seen in Missouri for a long time prior to our starting the fire treatments at Chilton Creek. Within the first three rounds of fire treatments, the plant was proliferating in the fire management units and continues to be very common at the site. That's kind of a success story because this is a species that is potentially of conservation concern. We just don't know much about it. This is the only place in the state where we are, and one of few places in North America where we know it still occurs. It may be a plant that was once much more common in the environment, but with the cessation of the wildfires to which the system was attuned, it was no longer able to compete. And so we're seeing stories like that. We're also seeing increases in some plants that are generally thought to be fairly sensitive. Some types of orchids in the wetter spots of the site seem to be increasing, although we don't have hard numbers on that yet. So what we're seeing is we've taken this large-scale preserve and we've spent considerable resources in being able to apply large-scale fire management to the site and new an extremely intensive and disciplined series of studies, including the vegetation study I talked about, to track the effects of this. The jury's not in on how that's going to work completely yet. We won't know a lot till we have analyzed the final data, but the initial impressions are we are moving along the lines we like to see towards a structure that lets enough light into the ground layer to allow this explosion of this ground layer vegetation. And you might ask, well, what's that mean? You're growing lots of plants on the ground. Is that useful? And I would say there's two answers to that question that are linked. One is, we know that healthy forests require healthy soil and healthy water balances. We also know that the only way water soaks into the ground is if the soil is porous, and we know that the more carbon in that soil and the more micropores in that soil, the more water will soak into the ground. And we know the more ground cover vegetation you have, the more carbon and the more micropores you have in that soil because of the fine root structure of these plants. So we believe that the health of woodland and forest systems in the Ozarks is dependent upon a healthy, diverse cover of herbaceous plants at the ground layer, the wildflowers and grasses and sedges. We also know the early historic accounts of the pre-settlement forest again and again refer to the profusion of grasses and wildflowers and the openness underneath the canopy. So if we are truly going to sustain the resources and the habitats of the Ozarks, we have to try to get that rich root structure associated with that ground cover back. The other thing that it occurs at a larger scale is that we know the aquatic systems in the Ozarks are very important. They're important economically because of recreation. They're important biologically because they support all kinds of aquatic critters, some of which are found nowhere else in the world. We also know that much as we talk about floodplains in terms of water management, when we talk about water quality and water management, it's really an upland issue. And it's the health of the uplands in any watershed that determine the fate of the downstream resources, including the aquatic life. So if we are going to really succeed in landscapes that are largely timbered, like the Ozarks, if we're going to succeed in sustaining the water resources there, we have to have healthy watersheds that allow most of the rain to infiltrate into the ground, recharge the groundwater aquifers, be available to be metered out into the systems during the driest periods of the year, and not run off rapidly right after the rainfall event and erode and scour the habitats and thus poison the downstream resources. So I think the answer to the bigger picture puzzle is if we're going to succeed in sustaining the aquatic resources of the Ozarks, we have to succeed in sustaining the upland resources in terms of their watershed outputs to the system. We know this requires a lot of diverse ground layer vegetation, and we're using Chilton Creek as a demonstration platform and a model to test the role of fire in making this happen. So long term, then, we would like to see Chilton Creek available. The data is going to be freely available to a variety of practitioners. It's a demonstration area where hunters have already seen firsthand the benefits of fire in terms of increasing the habitat and increasing the food sources for game animals and other animal life, because the more ground layer vegetation, the more different fruits and seeds and nuts that are produced, all of which make a better hunting experience. So there's also a sort of an indirect aesthetic endorsement of the type of thing we're doing in there. I would say initially there was a lot of skepticism among the local community. That's been transformed into strong support among the sportsmen's groups as they see the role of fire in sustaining and promoting habitats for wildlife as well. So that in a nutshell is what's happening at our Chilton Creek Preserve these days, why we think it's important. Moving forward, we're going to be looking at the data analysis that comes out of this year. We'll make some hard decisions then about how best to advance the continuing restoration of the site, and we will be aggressively sharing our results with the community at large, both in the public sector and in the private sector, to try to make that another model that's available as a tool for both the forest products industry, for wildlife habitat management, and for the conservation community.
Okay, well, wow, that was a great overview. Just have a couple questions that came in while Doug was talking. And the first one was sort of answered when you talked about the tick trefoil that you found that hadn't been there. But is that the most unusual plant that you found there this year, or the most surprising? Or I guess it sounds like that it was reappearing before this year. But
well, that's a good question. I'd say the tick trefoil was perhaps the most gratifying direct conservation success story is here's something that was known to be a part of Missouri's flora, of Missouri's biological heritage, hadn't been seen for decades. We start applying large-scale fire management, and not only does it appear, but it proliferates and becomes relatively common in some of those side slopes in the site. But some other things have occurred as well. As everyone knows, we had an unusually wet year this year. We started seeing an orchid, the ragged-fringed orchid, within the preserve. The ragged-fringed orchid is a neat plant. It's relatively uncommon. It's not in any danger. It's not of conservation concern. But what's interesting is the earliest accounts of ragged-fringed orchid always said in woodlands. I, in my life, had never seen it in the woods. It's moderately common on some wetter prairies in southwestern Missouri and the few remnant prairies that are left in northern Missouri. But we'd never seen it in the woods despite these early accounts. Once we started burning these woods and they started opening up, apparently some sort of dormant seed bank of ragged orchids that was in the that had persisted all these years, and orchids are known to do that, found the site favorable again and resprouted. It's an interesting historic endorsement that, yes, this was a part of our woodland biodiversity, and we would have lost it had we not continued that. In terms of rare and endangered plant species, there are not a large number there, but we've got some other pretty cool plants there. We've got the showy lady slipper. We've got the yellow lady slipper. They are thriving under the fire management regime as well. And again, it's interesting to note, there's over 700 native plant species in this 5,600-acre site. That's about a third of Missouri's native plants in this one small landscape. We've got about half of Missouri's native land snails, 52 species of land snails. We've got well over a third of Missouri's lichens. So as we continue using this as a test laboratory to test diversity and response to restoration and fire, we're learning more and more about the landscape and the incredible diversity at the site there. It's an unusually diverse site for the Ozarks, and that gives us an advantage to use it as a demonstration and test area.
Okay. I've got another question here, and I'm trying to phrase it. I hope that this is what the asker is meaning. The question is, what's being seen in terms of invasive plants, especially as the natives become established? And I think maybe the question is, are natives overcoming the invasives? Do we care? Or what? How do we see the relationship between the natives and the invasives?
It's a good question. I would say that we were fortunate with the Chilton Creek site that invasive species were fairly minimal. The biggest problem invasive species we have is an Asian clover or Asian legume called Sericea lespediza, which is very difficult to eradicate. There's often concern when you reintroduce a fairly large-scale disturbance such as fire that you're going to render the site more vulnerable to invasion by non-native species, particularly if the site has a disturbance history and there's a lot of open niches to be recolonized. That has not been the case at Chilton Creek. We've not seen an increase of invasive species. Most of the landscape, except some of the old fields in the bottoms along the creeks and the current river itself, were pretty free of invasive species anyways. And there's almost no invasive species that have appeared in any of the research plots. We do have a little bit of a problem with Sericea lespediza in the stream gravel banks themselves. And there's also some invasive animal species there. Earthworms, almost all the earthworms you see today are one of five old world species, and a few invasive aquatic species in the current river itself and its tributaries. But in answer to your question, we've not seen any proliferation of them, and in the fire management units, we've seen a diminution of, or a reduction of them, at least empirically. We've not got the data analyzed yet, except for Sericea lespediza, which is hanging on, and I don't think the fire has impacted. Sericea is one of the few invasive species we deal with that is fire adapted. Most invasive species decline in the space of fire. So, summary, invasive species are a concern. I think the fire management has rendered the site a little more resilient to them, but in the aquatic and the old field side of things, it's not going to solve our problems. We'll have to address it differently.
Okay, wow, that's great. As far as opportunities for sharing this information, the question is specific to other Nature Conservancy offices. Have they benefited from our doing this study with the Missouri Department of Conservation, or is that something that we're still working towards? What's the information sharing?
That's a good question. Again, I think we may be guilty of being a little too hesitant to share our information because being science geeks, we always want to have incontrovertible proof. So we're cautiously optimistic until we have the hard numbers. We haven't trumpeted this or published much on it. We have used it as a demonstration site and brought conservancy practitioners from some other programs. We brought some conservancy partner practitioners up from Brazil to see what's going on here because they were concerned with fire and woodland systems. So we've used it as a sort of empirical demonstration, but because we don't have hard numbers or data yet, we're just into the post-treatment analysis, we've not been standing up and saying, hey, look at this, this works. I think that would be premature. But we have used it a lot to do one thing, and that is to defray the fear a lot of people, both in the conservation community and in the public at large, have that fire is a destructive event. And we can take people up there and say, look, this area has been burned 10 times if we're in the annual burn unit, and look at it, it's beautiful. It's great wildlife habitat. It's great watershed character. We haven't killed all the trees. So I'd say it's gone a long way as an informal demonstration site for people to become a little more attuned to the fact that fire, just like anything, has positive and negative sides, and applied carefully and conceived and implemented with a goal-based philosophy, has profound benefits and not the destructive consequences people see.
Okay. Yeah, fire can be pretty controversial. I've experienced that a little bit myself and was surprised because I thought it was just something everybody thought was great. So.
Yeah, but imagine that, you know, you're living, your home is not far from Chilton Creek Preserve if you're an Ozark resident, and you hear these conservation people are going to come and light a fire. Well, you immediately think of a wildfire that killed Bambi's father, and you have bad images. So it's taken, quite frankly, some outreach and some convincing, and now that we've got the site with a long fire history, people, I think, are pretty attuned to it, and that's not a significant issue down there.
Okay. Well, just a quick last question, and I don't even know if you have an answer because it's pretty broad, but the question's been posed, what do you consider the biggest victory for this type of project? And maybe you just answered it with being able to show... have a working demonstration site, but is there something that you see as something that is just really valuable that is an outcome?
Well, I think you've said it. The valuable outcome is for the first time in Central North America, we have the beginnings of a long-term, disciplined data set that will allow to make totally objective judgments on landscape-scale fire management. And that's a hard thing to conceive because we can all... There's a fairly long history of little burns here and there, but doing a disciplined, long-term, integrated fire management study is hard to put together. And that's the value of it, both for the resource itself and for the demonstration and exportability to other woodland systems and watersheds in mid-continental North America.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great way to end this. We're just about to the end of our time as well, and I just wanted to thank everybody for participating. Thank Doug for sharing this with us. Remind everybody that our next Scientist Showcase is going to be on November 19th, and we will make sure we have information posted on the web soon for that. For more information on how to support nature conservancy projects in Missouri and around the world, please visit the website. And if you have specific Missouri questions, please call 314-968-1105. Or email us at missourievents@tnc.org. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.